Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today. Well, today, a tech-savvy parent with a bit of money to spend can monitor almost every aspect of their baby's health around the clock. The Dream Sock, for example, is a sleep tracker that also measures a newborn's heart rate and blood oxygen level. A typical baby monitor today comes equipped with a camera, higher-end models, even night vision. But is this information helpful, or does it just leave new parents stressed out? Damon Barris is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the technology section. His work focuses on the effects of technology on people and the planet, and he recently wrote about tech aimed at new parents. Welcome to the show, Damon Barris.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I should say at the get-go, I'm not a parent, but you are. You're a new father, so you have some firsthand experience with this, right?
I sure do. Our son is 9 months old, and we have spent every one of those months staring at our video feed from the camera in his room, making sure that he's sleeping comfortably, that nothing's going wrong in the crib, etc.
Do you find it's just hard to look away?
It's impossible to look away, first of all, because obviously, he's very cute. You know, you like looking at your cute little guy sleeping on the camera. But also because when you look at your live video feed, it's impossible not to feel a kind of anxiety or uncertainty or fear, which I think is natural in any new parent. But when you have a device that is actually geared toward presenting you with the notion that something could go wrong in the crib while your baby is sleeping, your mind will find any number of scenarios to conjure about what might actually be happening in there.
Sure, I can imagine. And of course, today's baby monitors are a far cry from the audio-only devices that parents had in years past, right?
That's right. So exactly as you described, there are now a number of very popular baby monitors from a number of different companies that do connect to cameras and transmit live video feeds with night vision, as you mentioned. Also, they'll show you the temperature of the room, and some models actually come equipped with artificial intelligence features that will notify you if, say, your baby's face has become obstructed by something, or even if your baby has coughed, it'll send a notification to your smartphone just in case you missed it on the live video feed. And there are different approaches here. Some of these models do in fact connect to your phone and you can look at the feed from wherever you are. Others are not actually connected to your Wi-Fi and just run on a closed circuit, which is perhaps a little bit more secure. But the effect in any case is to present the nervous parent with a live video readout of their child sleeping.
So it sounds like these technologies, whether this is helpful information or not, is certainly preying on the innate nervousness and concern that every new parent no doubt feels. I mean, do these serve a helpful purpose?
Yeah, of course, that's a fair question, right? I mean, the reason these things are successful is because a parent wants to make sure they're taking adequate care of their child and that they can stop something from going wrong. I think that, well, listen, I spoke to an expert at Northwestern University in Evanston, and his premise essentially is that 9 times out of 10, the information that you're receiving from a video monitor or even one of these different baby health trackers that you mentioned at the top of the show, 9 times out of 10, you don't really need to take action against anything that you're presented with. Of course, there is that 1 time out of 10 where maybe something has kind of obstructed your baby or something has gone wrong that obviously you need to urgently pay attention to. But I suppose what I might wonder is, you know, we have existed as a species for eternity, right? And there are certain things that are going to happen or not happen, and you're not going to be able to have your eyes glued on a device 24 hours a day. You have to sleep, you have to live your life. And it seems to me like the most likely outcome for a lot of parents is that they will spend a lot of their time worrying over these devices without necessarily needing to. Of course, there are specific there everyone has their own specific need, and certainly a parent should make the right decision for themselves. But when it comes to this kind of constant surveillance, it seems like it's actually not all that useful. The sort of thing that is actually useful, I should say, we know, for example, how to properly configure a crib now to be really safe for a baby by, it comes down to even how the crib is constructed with the slats under the mattress positioned in a certain way. And we know not to put safe, soft things in a baby's crib or a blanket when they're little. There have been legitimate advances in how we take care of our young ones. But these are not the sort of things that come about because we're monitoring them constantly with a video camera.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann Fisher today. And we're talking about technology geared toward young parents. Damon Barris is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the technology section. He's been writing about this and is also a new father, so has some firsthand experience with the technology geared toward parents watching on young ones. And Damon, the idea here is peace of mind, right? Has that been your experience, though? Have you come away with a greater peace of mind?
I can't say that I have. I mean, listen, any new parent, I think especially, with your first child, you're going to be nervous. I don't think I've ever spoken with someone who has had a child for the first time and said, "Oh, everything's great. This is so easy. I don't worry about anything." So it's very natural to worry. However, I do think that the presence of this monitor has in some ways exacerbated that anxiety, and that is supported by research that I've seen, conversations I've had with medical experts, who do indeed find that these devices, either a video monitor like the one I have, where you're just looking at your child sleeping all the time, or health trackers that show a baby's heartbeat or their blood oxygen levels, etc., they actually give you a lot of information to worry about without a lot of context around that information. So, for example, the temperature in your baby's room. My video monitor displays a readout of what the temperature is. It doesn't really contextualize it. I happen to know from Googling or talking to the doctor what the safe temperature of a baby's room is, but if I hadn't sought that information out myself, I wouldn't necessarily know what to do with that number. Nevertheless, it is presented to me, and sometimes I do end up fretting over whether a couple of degrees above what should be ideal for the baby's room is something that I actually have to intervene on. And that's the sort of thing that is really negligible. It's not incredibly important if the temperature swings a degree or two beyond the ideal, like 4 degree range. And yet, when I see that on the monitor, how am I not supposed to worry about that and think about whether I'm supposed to take some sort of action in response to it? So what these devices do is present you with information that you're kind of hardwired to want to worry about and take action against. And maybe that's not what every parent ought to be bringing into their homes. Perhaps, for example, a simple radio monitor like the ones many of us might have grown up with is actually adequate for people.
As you put in your piece in The Atlantic, you write that if you can check in on your sleeping baby with a quick glance, why wouldn't you? And I guess that's why so many parents feel justified in spending, $100 on a baby camera just to, like you said, make sure or I guess indulge those fears in a healthy way to make sure their young one is doing well.
Right. That's right. I think it's also right. So it's a very, exactly as you say, it's a very natural and I think even healthy impulse, right? You want to take care of your family. I do think it's worth keeping in mind, and this is not something that I actually addressed specifically in the article that I wrote, but there's also research suggesting that as you sort of normalize and habituate yourself to this monitoring technology, even with a young one, and indeed there are, you want to make sure that the baby is sleeping in a safe environment. So I guess if you're going to have a monitor, perhaps it makes sense when the baby's very young. But research also does show that parents are more likely to become helicopter parents who are constantly monitoring their children, even as they grow older, once they have introduced this type of technology into their lives. And so I think that it's really important to consider what exactly is the precedent that you are setting by bringing this technology into your home? What is the behavior that this technology is going to encourage in you as a parent? What does that mean for the relationship between you and your child? And how do you want to modulate that or consider that as the child grows older? Because it's not healthy to keep constant tabs on a child once they're a little bit older and really need their privacy to grow in a healthy way. All of these things, all of these factors are relevant even as you make a decision to take care of your newborn. So that's another wrinkle here that I think is really important to consider.
Yeah, you talk to some experts about that sort of idea of hypervigilance that these products can create in parents. Do they offer any advice on how to sort of find a middle ground where you're plugged in but not too worried, more so than is healthy? And have you yourself, found that sort of middle ground yet where you're able to check in on Junior, but everything's okay?
Yeah, so I should say just off the bat, my wife and I, we fret over the monitor. Perhaps it's not a constant obsession, at least not anymore. From time to time, we'll notice something and say, oh gosh, do we have to worry about that? But I think we're finding our way to a healthy middle ground. One thing that an expert I spoke with mentioned is that as a parent, you really do need to take care of yourself, right? So one of the things to keep in mind is that you are going to be a better parent if you are rested, if you are not anxious, if you've created space to take care of yourself, you will show up better for your child. And so, one of the things that has been recommended is if you are going to monitor your child, which again, you want to make sure the child is breathing, you want to make sure that they're sleeping. Apart from that, you don't necessarily need to obsess, right? So, one of the things that was suggested to me is that if you're going to get a monitor, perhaps you don't get one that connects to your smartphone and sends you notifications on your phone or something that presents itself in the context of an app that you will sort of mindlessly switch over to if you happen to be on Instagram or reading an article, perhaps say on theatlantic.com. You don't want to have these kind of idle check-in behaviors, or you don't want these notifications to be taking up a bunch of mental space needlessly. So perhaps something that might help is getting a monitor that exists on a closed circuit where you have the screen device separately that you can kind of put to the side and keep the audio on, but you don't necessarily need to be looking at something that's not going to be interrupting you during your leisure time on your phone, et cetera. These types of things can help.
Sound advice. Damon Barris is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the technology section, and he's been writing about technology geared toward young parents and keeping tabs on young ones there in the crib. We have more Tech Tuesday on the way. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today. And we're all familiar with the concept of the leap year, right? The extra day in February that comes around every 4 years. But a measurement known as a leap second is causing all kinds of headaches for the world's timekeepers, and there is a move afoot to eliminate it altogether. But given society's highly computerized infrastructure, that's no easy feat. Award-winning Toronto-based journalist Alana Mitchell wrote about the complexities of time in her recent article for the New York Times titled "Time Is Up for the Leap Second." Alana Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Okay, so we need sort of a primer here. The need for a leap second comes from a mismatch between the way we measure time, both from an astronomical perspective and from an atomic method. So explain all of this for us and how this works. What is time anyway?
Yeah, no, it's such a great question. It's basically in 1967, the world's timekeepers decided to make the official length of the second linked to the movement of an atom. It's a cesium atom, a cesium-133 atom. So they switched to instead we you know for ancient since ancient times, we've told time by looking at the heavens, by watching the sun move and the moon and tracking the rotation of the earth on its spin. But in 1967, the time makers of the world decided that they would instead look to the internal heartbeat of an atom as to tell time. And that meant that they set the length of an atom, the length of a second to that specific stretch of time, but they set it a tiny bit too short. And so what it means is that atomic time runs a little bit faster than atomic time, than astronomical time. But the thing is that they're still linked historically. We don't want to sever astronomical or celestial timekeeping from atomic timekeeping. And so every now and again they have to adjust so that these two time scales go back into sync. And the way they do that is that they stop atomic time for just a second and allow the Earth time to catch up. And that is when they insert a leap second into the time scale.
And this is just this, just like we were saying in the introduction, this is very analogous to the idea of adding a leap year every 4 years because it takes just a bit longer than 365 days to get around the sun, right? And so we make up for it. We like this idea that time is absolute and linked to the motions of of our planet and but that's really not the reality, is it?
Well, we have a lot of trouble controlling time, right? That's the and putting it into these little discrete measurements that we can all count on. It's quite difficult. It's fascinating to me that the atomic time is so incredibly regular. It's so different from Earth time, which is kind of wobbly, and it the Earth speeds up a little bit, it slows down a little bit, but we think of time as an absolute when in fact it's almost a construct of the human imagination.
Yeah, you're right that the leap second is both irregular and unpredictable because, as you said, the Earth's rotation is slightly erratic. And I think I read in the article we're actually slowing down a little bit each year as a whole. Is that right?
That's right. So all of a sudden, so when timekeepers first developed this, this concept of the leap second, and that was in 1972 when they started to, inserting these leap seconds to make atomic and astronomical time match. They never imagined, I mean, it's incredible to imagine, they never imagined that they would eventually have to insert a negative leap second. In other words, they'd have to remove a second from time. But that's actually what they're facing now, because almost at the same moment that they invented the leap second, Earth started to slow down just very slightly. And so now it's catching up with the atomic time.
And it almost goes without saying, but so much of today relies on a precise measurement of time, right? Computer networks, transportation systems, financial markets. Tell us about the bureau that oversees this regulation of time, the folks in charge.
The folks in charge are just outside of Paris at a place called Sèvres, and it's called the Bureau International de Poids et Mesures. So it's known as the BIPM. And they were formed as the result of an international treaty. The international treaty is almost 150 years old. So these were all sorts of countries got together and said, you know what, we have to have measurements that are the same wherever they're measured in the world. So you know, if you're going to measure a meter in Paris, it has to be the same as a meter in Cleveland. They all have to be exactly precisely the same. And so governments got together and signed an international treaty to make sure that called the treaty of the meter, to make sure that meters and other measurements were all going to be the same no matter where you measured them. So eventually time became knitted into that, and now so the time makers in Paris at the BIPM or in outside of Paris set the definitions for all of these different measurements. And there are seven fundamental measures. They are the kilogram and the meter and the second, and, you know, a bunch, you know, things they cover the way that we measure things in the world, and they all have to be the same. And the second among all of these is sort of the king, because six of the units, the fundamental basic units, depend on the second, and the second is not just a sort of a, so in other words, it's really I love this idea. I love this idea that you can actually measure things if you wanted to in a quantity of seconds rather than in a quantity of kilograms or pounds, because all of these other units can be described in terms of the second. So the second is a more important unit than any of the others by some incredible feat of math and imagination. But it's also part of a time scale. And so everybody needs to know that it's the same time wherever you're going, especially now because we've got these in very, very highly interconnected power grids, very highly interconnected telecommunication systems. They all have to know down to the, you know, to sometimes down to the billionth of a second what exact time it is. And that's where the BIPM comes in. They not only set the length or, you know, description of each of these units, but they also put them into a time scale that everybody can say, you know, is the same everywhere in the world.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann Fisher today, and we're talking about time and how we keep track of time and the very precise measurements of time. And my guest right now is Elena Mitchell. She's an award-winning Toronto-based journalist, author, and playwright who writes about how science intersects with society. And Elena, there was a meeting November 18th in Versailles with the Bureau of Weights and Measures. A vote was taken on what's known as Resolution D. What's going on here, and what was the outcome of the vote?
Okay, so there were all these problems among technology companies, and not just technology companies, but anybody who really uses digital systems was having a lot of trouble with these inserting these leap seconds. It became really messy, and timekeepers don't like time to be messy. They like it to be very, very precise. So there were all these messinesses happening all over the world with the insertion of these leap seconds. And so the timekeepers, so the metrologists of the world, have got together and said, you know what, we think that we should switch to a different system. We should just eliminate the leap second. And so in Versailles on the 18th of November, they put a vote to the countries of the world who are signatories to this Treaty of the Meter and said, you know, we think that we should eliminate the leap second in effect. There's a little bit of, you know, verbiage there that is, but effectively what they said is by 2035, we want to stop doing leap seconds and we want to come up with another way to reconcile astronomical time and atomic time, and we're going to give ourselves 100 years, you know, of fluidity in this, and we're going to come up with something different. And it turned out on November 18th in Versailles that almost all the countries in the world said yes, let's do that, and so they voted to kill the leap second in effect.
And this was a long time coming, right? Getting this on the agenda.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What took so long?
Oh, well, it's very political. Time is very emotional. Time is very political. It's if you're the UK, the United Kingdom, for example, you have this historical and emotional connection to astronomical time, which is, you know, contained in Greenwich Mean Time. For example, winter time in the UK is in England is still tethered to Greenwich Mean Time as opposed to the international system. So they have these long historical connections, links to astronomical time. But in the end, the UK said, yes, we want to, abandon the leap second. But in the case of Russia, for example, Russia has a satellite global positioning system called GLONASS, and it incorporates leap seconds. And so for them to get rid of leap seconds, they have to do a whole bunch of retooling of their systems. Other global positioning systems like GPS, which is owned by the American government, don't use leap seconds. So there are all of these sort of philosophical and financial issues.
Sort of like the adjusting for the Y2K bug that we were all
It
worried
was.
about so many years ago, and it's
And
it, yeah.
yeah, and that and that and that didn't end up being the catastrophe that people expected because there was so much thought and work put into making sure that it didn't. But it's a very, very similar concept. It's like, how do you, if you are a timekeeper, how do you describe the time, 24 hours and 59 minutes and 60 seconds? You don't. It's 24, 59, 59.
And
That's the second.
yeah, and the other question I wanted to ask is, digital technology. We're as we said, we're just surrounded by sort of everyday technology that relies on precise measurements of time. How does this factor in?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly the problem. So you could end up with this tiny mismatch, especially during the period of adjustment when there's a leap second. You could end up with this time, this this period when times don't match. And so if you've got, for example, a financial transaction that is supposed to be time stamped and traceable down to the billionth of a second, how do you know whether you've got the right billionth of a second if you're in this adjustment period? That's the and so. Organizations like Meta, which runs Facebook, for example, just were pulling their hair out over this and saying, do we have to actually use
Yeah,
this second?
and I have to think this plays a this is a big consideration in matters of finance and the stock market and everything
Exactly.
too, where these rapid transactions are taking place. Every millisecond counts.
Well, they said I was reading somewhere that you can get something like six thousands of transactions in are possible in the blink of an eye, and that need to be time stamped to a specific portion of a second. And so when you're talking about a whole second to you and me as we sit here, a second doesn't seem that much, but to a computer, a second is composed of billions of other smaller time pieces. And that's what's at risk, is that they won't mesh during certain periods. So it's very expensive and very, very fiddly and error-prone process is the issue.
So what happens next now? Do we just flip a switch and we're done with the leap second? What's the timetable for eliminating the leap second?
Well, it won't happen until 2035, but it apparently will happen. It could happen a little earlier. I mean, Canada, for example, asked for the leap second to be eliminated by 2030, but that didn't go forward. So 2035 is the date. At that point, astronomical time and atomic time will start to diverge. And the resolution that was voted on by all these countries said that it can diverge for the next century after that. So for a century, there will be no adjustment to account for the differences between atomic and astronomical time. But in the meantime, the metrologists of the world are going to try to figure out how to do something that is easier for digital technologies to handle. So they may end up with a digit with instead of a leap second, maybe it'll be a leap minute, or maybe a leap hour, or maybe it will be something that has to do with frequency, as opposed to the length of time of a second, something that we can't even conceive of in a really technical way yet. So they're thinking of how else can we do this that will not make things so incredibly messy when it has to happen. But the thing that that fascinates me about all this is that they're still committed, philosophically committed to having humans tell time celestially. So even though we can tell time to this incredible degree of precision by atomic clocks now, and conceptually you don't need to know where the sun is, you don't need to know where the earth is in its spin. they're still saying, you know what, as humans, we still need to tell time by where we are positioned in the heavens, in the universe, in fact. And so it becomes this, and they're saying we must retain that, even though atoms are better timekeepers than the Earth, than the solar system, we still need to retain this ancient connection to the heavens.
Yeah, that fascinates me as well, and this idea that the Earth revolves and comes back to the same spot it was at before. But really, that's a misnomer, because the sun and the solar system are moving through the cosmos and in a different spot than we were a year ago. And but we feel this sort of primal need to be connected to this the cycle.
It's exactly right. It is this primal emotional need to somehow be connected to that cosmos you just talked about, somehow feel that we are part of it. And fascinating to me is that, you know, atoms, of course, are part of that. But we don't have the same sort of visceral sense of where we are in relationship to the sun and moon. You know, when we think about time being told by an atom, it just doesn't work in the same way. It's not intuitive to us, whereas, you know, the sun is.
So we've got a few years before we kill the leap second. Once we do, are people going to notice in any sort of practical, tangible, everyday sort of sense that there's something a little off here that we are no longer accounting for?
No, I don't think people will notice anything at all. I mean, we all the time, you know, we have daylight savings time in many countries, and you know, we flip that hour, you know, all the time. We're constantly, even within a single time zone, there can be changes of, you know, of as much as 3 hours in where we are in relationship to the sun, depending on where you are in a single time zone. So I think we have the capacity to adjust. We're quite flexible when it comes to this. But I think the thing that we're not quite so flexible about is just retaining this ancient tether, you know, to where we are in the universe. And that seems to be quite fundamental. So
yeah,
I think we'll keep that.
It's fascinating. Award-winning Toronto-based journalist Elena Mitchell wrote about the complexities of time in her recent article for the New York Times titled "Time is Up for the Leap Second." Elena Mitchell, thank you so much. More Tech Tuesday on the way here on All Sides with Ann Fisher, 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today. Google announced yesterday that it has licensed its breast cancer screening AI research model to medical technology company iCAD. This is the first time Google is licensing the technology that it hopes will lead to more accurate breast cancer detection and risk assessment. Here to tell us more is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. Big tech getting into the medical field. What can you tell us about Google's breast cancer screening AI?
Yeah. So this is actually an expansion of Google's efforts to work with medical groups, in particular when it comes to cancer research. There's been a lot of tech that has gone into this in the past. Usually what it involves, especially in this case, is being able to take as many different pictures as possible and analyze them to identify patterns and potential risk factors against just enormous databases of images that had already been taken of you know, many, many, many different stages of breast cancer.
Now, the issue that these AI systems are running into is, right, there's no agreed upon gold standard for diagnosing cancer, and that can make it difficult to, say, train an algorithm. That's kind of what we're looking at, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no such thing as one single kind of cancer, and that is also true of breast cancer. So there's not a single way to identify, you know, kind of those early stages. But what they're are several kind of models that can be generated for early warnings that would lead to further testing. So it's not accurate in a way that a set of radiology images would immediately determine, you know whether someone was completely cleared or in some sort of risk, but it can create a range of analysis to identify whether someone should potentially go for further testing.
How does this AI work exactly? Or is it true artificial intelligence, or is this should we think of this more as just a tool that physicians theoretically could use to for their diagnoses?
This is definitely the latter there. When it comes to the term artificial intelligence, what we're really looking at here, Google's definition, is this thing called, a big graph, where it takes an enormous amount of information in order to identify trends. So this is, Google has worked with several different organizations to capture just a truly spectacular number of X-ray photos and different technologies for taking different pictures, including some of the more advanced 3D imaging software that goes in there, and using that to identify things like tissue density, and any inconsistencies within the body tissue based on prior examples. So it is not a take a single picture and say, nope, you're totally clear, there's a green thumbs up on the screen, everything's fine. But it does say, hey, based on other images that we have, these are kind of the warning signs that have been found in other patients.
All the way back in 2020, Google researchers published a paper in the journal Nature that found its AI system outperformed several radiologists in identifying signs of breast cancer. The model reduced false negatives by up to 9.4% and reduced false positives by up to 5.7%. And do we know how close this tech is to being deployed? And it sounds like there's a human element here that is still required. How much longer are we going to definitely be looking at humans playing an important role here?
So this is definitely going to be something that humans are playing an important role in for the foreseeable future. There's not like a plan point where you'd be able to go in and have a robot, handle all this and have it be done. As far as it being something that is live, that's the whole point of this announcement, is licensing this technology to this medical company, iCAD, means that any medical professional who works with iCAD would have access to versions of this technology. So being able to use that software to analyze, existing tissue images and things like that. And what it really comes down to, the numbers that you gave there regarding the false negatives and false positives, really comes down to that kind of wide array of images. Medical professionals, who dedicate their entire lives to this work, still only have that kind of narrow band of experience for the things that they've touched. Even if they've been doing it for 20 years, the amount of data that this platform would have access to would wildly surpass that.
There were some instances in Google's 2020 research when radiologists spotted cancer that the AI didn't see, and medical experts generally approach AI with caution. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And that's the correct approach for right now. We have no shortage of examples of artificial intelligence being used in other places and having it be less than great, as we talked about a little bit last week. The overall, kind of goal here is to make sure that medical professionals have as many tools as possible, and being able to kind of see that as a general, progressing force. And it also benefits the technology that Google is using to have access to more and more data. The way that it claims artificial intelligence works is the more information it has access to, the more kind of tweaks to its system can be made, until a point where it is eventually something that could be used with that sort of comforting guarantee.
All right. So still a long way off from dunking me in a Bacta tank and just curing whatever's wrong with me.
That's right.
Star Wars reference, kids. All right. Switching gears a little bit. Russell, Facebook's parent company Meta has been hit with another hefty penalty for breaching European data protection laws. What's going on there?
Yeah. So back in April of 2021, there was an incident reported where Facebook had a data breach, where an old tool that Facebook had released didn't have security features added to it until later. And those security, that lack of security features in that product were quickly exploited. in order to grab information from personal accounts. When Facebook caught it, they didn't say a ton about it. And then it got reported by several European regulatory groups that this was something that required deeper investigation. Facebook tried to say that the information that had been floating around was what they called old data, and that it was something that they had fixed a long time ago and wasn't really a big deal. But the European regulators disagreed to the tune of $275 million in fines.
Wow. So this is the lack of reporting on Facebook/Meta's part is what got them into trouble with the European regulators. Is that correct?
That's definitely part of it. The other part is, you know, Europe has this thing called the European Union General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. And a big part of GDPR is that if you are a company operating in an EU country, and you are, you know, taking someone's data for a purpose, you have to guarantee a certain level of protection for that data. You have to guarantee that, you know, it is it's something that only you and the person who gave that data have access to, unless they have given permission to share that data with other places. And in not being able to deliver that, you know, Facebook was able to get themselves in a little bit of trouble here.
All right. In addition to the hefty fines, regulators are also asking Facebook to take some remedial action. What are they asking for specifically?
Yeah. So, I mean, a big part of the remedial action here is it's actually interesting because this is part of a larger thing that the EU has been asking of Facebook for some time now, and that is to make sure that the ongoing processing of personal data has this this, you know, set of searchability settings so that they can be almost audited in a way by the GDPR groups on a fairly regular basis.
And broadly speaking, I mean, it seems to me as a novice observer that European regulators and here in the US, it's sort of a different playing field, right? As far as the strict nature of what the folks in Europe are looking for.
It is wildly different, the data rules between the US and the European Union. And it's something that has only gotten more, you know, kind of strangely different over the last couple of years, with GDPR being something kind of relatively new as far as the EU is concerned. Here in the US, the closest thing you get to the same kind of user data protections come usually when you involve financial data. The, you know, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has some rules in place as far as, you know, not being able to take advantage of someone or, you know, having to report it when certain financial activities are taken. But when it comes to your actual personal data, if you go on the internet and, you know, share in a private post that you are 15 years old and you're walking to the grocery store right now, there is no assumption, even though you have marked that post private, that it is in fact private.
All right, user beware. Russell, earlier this year, Microsoft announced a deal to acquire Activision Blizzard, the company behind the popular Call of Duty video game franchise. Microsoft has been speaking with regulators around the world in an effort to gain approval for the acquisition, and now we've learned that they are preparing to offer concessions to EU regulators to get approval for the deal. What's going on here?
Yeah, we're spending a lot of time in the EU today. One of the big things that came from announcing this merger of these two companies, one acquiring the other, is that Activision Blizzard makes a ton of games that are available on multiple platforms. In particular, the most recent Call of Duty games are extremely popular both on Xbox and PlayStation. They made a smaller Nintendo Switch port. It's a PC title. And there is concern amongst European Union regulators that Microsoft would acquire Activision Blizzard and then make all of its games only available on the Xbox. Now, it is worth highlighting that this same set of strictures did not apply to Sony when they did exactly the same thing, acquiring a company and then making its game no longer available on the Xbox. But this has been a vocal commentary from the European Union regulators over the last couple of weeks is, you know, in order to approve this you know, merger going forward, there would need to be some sort of acknowledgement that this kind of behavior wouldn't happen as a competitive thing, that they wouldn't just pull for no reason games on that are currently available everywhere, pull them back into a single platform. Microsoft and the EU have not made the complete list of what the concessions that Microsoft has offered public yet. But it is widely suspected that, you know, this is a big part of it, is making sure that Microsoft is promising that the games that are made by Activision Blizzard that were originally designed to go on multiple platforms will remain available on those multiple platforms.
And how big is an issue with that? That seems to be always a big sticking point with a lot of these games where fans want to see these games that were on a PlayStation or an Xbox be able to be played on their PC or vice versa. And there's at times resistance to that.
It's a tough challenge because, you know, on the one hand, you know, there are, you know, just millions and millions and millions of gamers all across the world who have one or another of these platforms, and being able to afford more than one is a privilege and a luxury at this point. They're you know, $500 consoles. At the same time, Microsoft and Sony both have, and Nintendo for this matter, have an enormous amount of data, which demonstrates that if you release a big game that is just on your platform, people will go and buy those consoles just to play those games. Sony's most recent God of War Ragnarok is an incredible game that you can only play on a PlayStation 5 or a PlayStation 4. And the moment that that game came out, people went hunting for the new PlayStation 5 in order to start playing that game. They were waiting specifically for that to come out. The same with, you know, Horizon Forbidden West. You know, there are Horizon Forbidden Wilds. There's a lot of games like that. Halo, you know, any kind of Pokemon game on the Nintendo Switch, you know, those exclusives sell consoles and keep people on those platforms for a very long time. You know, so buying a company as massive as Activision Blizzard is 100% a way to guarantee that people stay on your Xbox platform for a while. And European Union is going to try and slow that down a little bit, it looks like.
So this is a significant acquisition then for Microsoft. How big of a shakeup or how much of a impact will this have on the industry as a whole?
It's an interesting question because, you know, when you look at some of the, you know, kind of top performing games across the world in the last 10 years, Activision Blizzard is responsible for, I think, three of them. You know, across, you know, all of the games that have been released over the last couple of years. It's a huge company that makes an enormous number of games across a ton of different platforms. And for Microsoft to own all of that in one place would have a pretty dramatic change on the landscape, not just when it comes to, you know, what platform those games are on when you go to play them, but also people who work in the game space who, you know, develop video games and create graphics and things like that. You know, Microsoft is rated as a really incredible place to work. And so having all of those people in one house, you know, could cause folks who work in smaller studios to decide to go and work somewhere with a little more stability and reliability.
In just the last couple of minutes we have left, I also saw you were writing about some things on your maybe holiday shopping list or things that you might recommend to folks, a pair of workout headphones that you've really enjoyed.
Yeah, so folks who listen to this on a regular basis know that I love bone conduction headphones, especially when I'm working out outside, because it means that I can hear cars and I don't get hit by cars nearly as often as I used to, because I have those bone conduction headphones on a regular basis. My personal favorite are made by a company called Shox, S-H-O-K-Z, and their headphones are called the Open Run Pros. They are really, really great headphones that last quite a while. And they were, for as a part of kind of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, about $40 off.
Yeah. And what's the sound quality like for people who maybe haven't listened to bone conduction headphones before compared to a more traditional set?
It's kind of a weird experience because these headphones don't actually go in your ears and they don't actually cover your ears. So you still hear everything that's going on in the world, but there is vibration that goes in through your mastoid process, the actual bone on your cheek. In order to you know, produce that sound. So things sound a little different. I find them really, really great for audiobooks and podcasts. Spoken word comes in really, really clearly, and I don't have to worry about any kind of volume controls. Music I find really great, with the single caveat that the louder you have a song that you go to play, the increase in vibration there is. And these can get quite loud to a point where you can actually feel the vibration on your skin, and that can be irritating to some. But overall, you know, if I am anywhere, you know, kind of outside, or if I'm just sort of wandering through my house or cooking or something like that, I find them incredibly comfortable.
All right. And you can't beat that safety factor of being able to hear your surroundings better.
It is really important when you're outside.
Yeah. Russell Hawley, thank you as always. Russell Hawley is managing editor for commerce at CNET. And this has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Rand on 89.7 NPR News.